grow trees and it won't grow corn, it ought to be marginal. Now, I don't know why we have to get all involved in the rest of it. Income tests, et cetera, et cetera. Is there something I'm missing that land that won't grow trees and won't grow corn should not be marginal?
Madam Chair?
Lois is shaking her head.
Madam Chair?
Representative Troop.
Those of us east of the mountains live in areas that might not necessarily grow corn or watermelon or cantaloupe or some of those kinds of products. But we certainly have some awfully good grazing land. We have some awfully good pasture land that can, in some instances, carry cattle, carry sheep, maybe carry horses, maybe even carry llamas. I think there are other things than vegetables that one produces for the table. There are livestock and animal life and those kinds of things.
Yeah, I think there's another. That's a big hole, and there's where maybe you want to talk about an income test. So many animals are.
Well, I think there's another consideration.
So many, but
there's another consideration there too. What's the cost of providing public facilities to, if we were to do this hopscotch development all over creation? What's the cost to everybody else of providing the public facilities? There are some goals that deal with that, but I think that's a concern. Also, we've heard some of the agriculturalists come in time after time before this committee and indicate that if we take land that might be considered marginal, if there's a little piece here that might be considered marginal, if we are to urbanize all of those rural areas, those agriculture areas, by allowing that kind of development out in rural lands, agriculture lands, forest lands, that we're going to have an impact on the ability of those lands to be able to continue to produce Oregon's number one industry and Oregon's number two industry. So I think we have other considerations other than just the soil type or whether or not that land or whatever we want to define marginal as. I think there are other considerations that we have to take into account. I don't think we can simplify it as much as your statement.
I think Representative Anderson, Representative Troop, and Lois, I think, would like to come up and say something. Is that this is exactly what this language is, what we're attempting to do is determine those lands through the soil classifications, the small lot ownership, and the income test, exactly that won't grow corn or won't grow trees. It's just how do you say that in law? And
no,
that makes some sense.
Madam Chairman, I think there's a relatively easy answer to why the income test is necessary. We're describing, in part of this test, what we think are poor soils. And we're saying soils worse than class 4. So that makes 5 through 8 poor soils. When you get to central and eastern Oregon, the majority of ranches out there, and in Douglas County too, a lot of ranches, graze class 6 soil. Okay, if the poor soils test is the only thing that's applied to that land, then it becomes marginal just by virtue of the fact that it's class 6 soil. And yet, it's productive land, at least it is now. It's part of operating ranches that produce a lot of income. That's why, for the very same reason, when Goal 3 was developed in 1974, and it was initially proposed to cover just class 1 through 4 soils, Eastern Oregon ranchers and farmers came in and said, wait a second, that's not giving us any protection. Okay, that's what the income test does. It protects those ranching operations, basically, that operate at least part on class 6 soils from all turning into marginal lands. If they're part of a ranching operation that doesn't produce $20,000, they can be marginal lands. But if they're producing $20,000 or more and have historically, why should they be marginal? Why shouldn't they get exclusive farm use protection?
Madam Chair.
Representative Parkinson.
It seems continually in our discussions on land use that some members of the committee think that automatically, if some of us are wanting to respond to the wishes of the people and relaxing some of these things, that we're automatically want to subdivide the state. And I'm getting sick and tired of hearing it. I don't want to subdivide the state. I want to save the farmland just like everybody else does. And another thing I think I resent to some extent is that we all seem to think that county officials and the county zoning and everything will not absolutely not work, that they can't be trusted. And another thing, while I'm spouting off, is I don't think in a few lines that we can fine-tune these conditions so that it fits all areas of the state. I think it's ridiculous. Eastern Oregon's different from Western Oregon. The coast different from Southern Oregon's different. And I certainly would like to see us go in the direction of giving some power to be able to define marginal lands to the counties. I just think the income test is really not going to work. We'll have a mess like that on a lot of records last session. Where it helps you already.
Chairperson?
Representative Trahern and then Representative Priestley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I guess, I'm sorry, I apologize for being late, but I guess just taking that last comment that was made by those testifying, is there something in the bill that requires us to say that some of these poor soils in southern or eastern Oregon are automatically going to be marginal land, or conversely, that they cannot have farm use values on those or farm use on those lands just because they have to be grazing lands? Is there a requirement that we take them out of farm use? I don't believe there is. I think it only says that it can be allowed, and I think it's to tell those folks that we're going to tell them that we're going to force them to come out of farm use. I think that's a little different than to say we might allow it if it meets the requirements of the local government body. That's a different philosophy.
Lois, did you want to come up and talk about that one thing?
I had a question back for that.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Priestley, go ahead.
I'm just trying to get through this bill, and so I'm right up here in this. We deleted line one, and I wanted to, so I'm right in the second, third words of line two.
Yeah.
The idea of part of or contributed to. I didn't get the distinction you made, Ms. Norman, because that seemed to be kind of a profound distinction. I'm thinking about some kind of a farm which was a nice, wonderful farm, and next door was a pile of rocks, and it happened to be. Maybe this pile of rocks, it was 5 acres of rocks, but there's also 5 acres of something else that belonged to the adjoining somebody else, somebody that lived in Kansas City, say. And that was a leased portion to this dynamic, wonderful farm. But this pile, now, so contributed to and part of kind of makes a distinction to me in that sense. Can you speak to it in that sense?
The point I was making was that if, under this language, if you use part of instead of significant contribution, it says part of a farm operation. So if it's, that would be interpreted, is intended to mean any farm operation, a farm operation. So if it was part of, if it was leased to a farmer who used it as part of his farm operation, then it's part of a farm operation, even though it's not part of the farm operation of the person who actually owns it. So, and that would simply be a matter of changing that language from a farm operation to describing it as the farm operation of the owner.
I didn't understand what you said, but is it because my pile of rocks analogy was not a valid way to view part of or contributed to? I'm trying to focus on just part of or contributed to, then we can go on to these thousands of other questions we all have.
Representative Priestley, I think what she's saying when she says, now forget the rock analogy for just a minute. When you say the land is a part of a farm operation, mm-hmm, that produced 20,000 or more in gross income, you have, it would seem to me if Farmer Jones is leasing 20 acres down the road from Farmer Smith, when Farmer Smith turned around and wanted to make that 20 acres marginal, he couldn't because it's part of Farmer Jones's operation that produced $20,000 a year. That's the problem when you say part of.
It's
using A instead of B.
I'm trying to get the, between part of and contributed to.
Right.
Is it a moot? I still don't understand.
No, this one.
Ben.
When I brought this issue to you, I brought up the 20,000. If you are going to use 20,000, only that what criterion you'd use to determine the 20,000. There is still much dispute over whether or not you talk in language of is not part of or did not make a contribution to. So we're now overlapping the issues. Perhaps you would rather decide the more controversial one
first. Which is what?
Whether you use language is not a part of or did not make a significant contribution to. That is why I did not put a delete here. I just made these little lines through. So those are the two options that have been suggested there.
Well, I'd be pretty, if we want to go, since I haven't achieved any additional understanding on this discussion, I'd rather it would be fine if we went to another one now, just so we keep them separate.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hill and then Representative Troop.
I have two questions along this line for Elizabeth.
Just part of her contributed to, Larry, or is it something else?
No, this
along way. The same line.
Okay.
Part of. If we have an operation, a farm operation of, say, 2,000 acres, and the farmer does not operate 200 of those 2,000 acres, would that be part or not part of the operation?
My understanding, well, I guess it depends on what you mean by not operate. If
he let it lie completely fallow, did nothing.
What would you interpret that as? The language is written, though, but that's...
Lois Kanegi, Agriculture for Oregon, Representative Hill, Chair Hooley. In regard to that particular dilemma, that was one thing I think that did concern us. I would like to speak in a few minutes again to the question that Representative Anderson asked about the validity of the $20,000 income test or any kind of income test. But this was one of the problems why Ag for Oregon really wrestled hard with whether it should be a significant contribution or a contribution or not part of, because we understood that there might be a ranch where there would be 200 acres that were off to the side and really had not been a part. Our solution, and it may not be an ideal one, but it seemed that it would probably be the most consistent with the terminology that we need to protect other farm operations. The option for that rancher would be that he could, in fact, sell that 200 acres to someone else who then could apply for a marginal land category. I think that would probably solve the problem. Now, again, it doesn't seem quite fair, but then how does one write protective language that somehow is consistent, and that still would give him an option?
My second question, Madam
Representative Hill.
We have testimony before of the farmers. I don't know from personal experience, but most farmers seem to lease all or part of their land, and it tends to be in several different places scattered around wherever they can obtain a good piece of land at a fair rate. Suppose we have a fairly parcelized area with a 150-acre piece that's not built upon. It's still farmland, basically. The owner of that piece would like to get the most money out of it he can, so he'd like to divide it up for rural residential. But the farmer down the road would also like to lease that piece of land and run some cattle on, you know, or put in some peppermint. Now, that could, if the farmer could only get the lease on it, be part of a productive operation. But if the owner refuses to place it on the market for lease, by definition, it's not productive. See, and my thinking is most farms tend to have these 150-acre pieces and 200 pieces, 200 pieces, and they're scattered around. So what I'm thinking is, if we have a parcelized area with a pretty good-sized piece on with good soils, people are going to hate this, but maybe we should have a test that it should be available for farm use. It should be available to become part of an operation if somebody wishes to make that a productive piece of a farm operation.
Can I respond to that? Representative Hill, taking your 150-acre example, assuming it's in an area of small ownerships, mm-hmm. Okay, there are only two ways that could be qualified as marginal land. It's if it's poor soil, and then your concern about it being brought into production is lessened. It's poor soil, okay? Otherwise, it has to be part of the small ownerships area. Well, I think as you look at the way the small ownerships area works on the ground, the chances of being able to include a 150-acre parcel in a small ownerships area that comes up to the standards of the Act, that is, 50% of the area is in ownership smaller than 20 acres, or 20 acres or smaller, there's almost no chance that you're going to be in that situation.
I would like to welcome the students from Upward Bound program from Portland, and what we are trying to discuss today is, in sort of fumbling around in this committee, we are working on marginal lands and how do you define that through statute, even though you may be able to walk out in a field or an area and recognize that that land is rocky and the soil is poor, that it's really not good farmland. How do you define that in statute that applies statewide? So that's what we're working on today. Welcome.
It's too bad there isn't something that I think would be more interesting to them. This probably.
Yeah, this is. I'm sorry, we're not on an exciting. something that is a little, not quite so technical. I had Representative Troop and then Representative Representative Troop.
I can't remember my question.
Representative Anderson.
I guess it's along the same line. I think it's a given that we don't want to cut up 100-acre parcels that are croplands or potential croplands or so. What about, we've been talking about 2,000-acre operation. What about the 20 acres that's a rock pile that's not, I hate to go back to the language, making a significant contribution to that ranch? Do you hold that that should not be built on because it's part of the ranch? Or do you hold that maybe that could be 20 acres could be marginal land some way?
Representative Anderson, this bill is not aimed at that situation because that situation is already taken care of through the non-farm dwelling criteria in an EFU zone. If you've got a 500-acre farm or ranch with a 20-acre rock outcropping, regardless of where it is on the ranch, that person, the owner of that, can apply for a non-farm dwelling or more than one non-farm dwelling and probably get it approved, because if the land is poor, as you've described it, they'll meet the test for a non-farm dwelling. The non-farm dwelling, the marginal lands bill is aimed at stretches of poor soil or those pockets of small ownerships that have been broken down and probably cannot in the future be consolidated into nearby commercial farms. Not the little parts of the farms around the Willamette Valley and the rest of the state that have a piece of bad land in. That's what the non-farm dwelling criteria are aimed at for non-farm dwellings.
Well, follow-up, this is all news to me, that you're able to subdivide off a ranch and farming operation because of poor soil. You mean you can really do that through some process?
Sure. 215.213(3).
Now, in my county, we have a 70-acre minimum for agriculture and 200 for grazing. We can't interfere with that, I assume.
That minimum lot size applies if you're proposing to divide land for farm purposes. But if you're proposing to divide off a 2-acre piece of your farm for a non-farm dwelling, assuming that it's poor land and it's not going to interfere with the farm, you can do that regardless of the minimum lot size. I mean, there's a separate minimum lot size that applies for creation of parcels for farm purposes. And there's no limit in the statute. There's no limit in the statute as to how many of them you can have, and there's no limit in the statute as to what size parcel they have to be. They just have to be large enough for sanitary purposes.
I think the committee is not as familiar with, I mean, we've been looking at this and pretty well stuck on page 2 of the first,
right,
the first 10 lines or 11 lines.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Truth.
That 215.213 gives the county the authority to look at that individual case and make the decision. Is that?
That's correct.
Yes. So that allows the county to become involved and make that decision.
Why is someone shaking their head? Go ahead and come up.
Name is Darrell Garrison, the Amador County Council, on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties.
Lois, stay up here because we want you to tell us.
Just to correct that misimpression, many county ordinances do not allow the division of non-farm lands in EFU zones.
But that is that's a county.
Well,
not it, through state statute.
215.213 allows the placement of a non-farm dwelling. 215.213 sub 3 does not deal with whether you can separate the land off or not, and it's a question of some controversy of just within the commission, LCDC, when you submit for acknowledgement, to the extent that they will allow non-farm separations. The only non-farm separations allowed, for instance, in Yamhill County are for retirement of the farmers.
But it sounds to me like that's a county ordinance, not a state statute, and Ron Eber, who's from LCDC, is violently shaking his head back there disagreeing with you. Ron, do you want to just come up and we're going to have shuffle time here.
Musical chairs.
Ron Eber, Department of Land Conservation and Development. I don't remember the situation in Yamhill County, but I can't think of any county that does not allow the division of a non-farm lot within its exclusive farm use zone, subject to the provisions of 215.213 sub 3. It's true a county may, on its own, decide not to allow them or set a maximum or minimum lot size for those particular partitions. But every ordinance I've reviewed, and that's most every ordinance in the state, allows it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Parkinson.
What if this 20 acres of unproductive land is located at the back of the man's farm and he needs to build a road to get to it? And can he still do it?
Representative Parkinson, again, that would be up to the county. In that case, instead of being a minor partition, it would be a major partition, so they can provide access.
So they can do it?
Correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative Troop.
You said you were attempting to straighten out a misperception. What was that misperception you were attempting to straighten out again?
Essentially that it's freely available to separate off non-farm lands.
Do you want to give your name again for record?
Darrell Garrison, Yamhill County Council.
So what in state statute or what is the LCDC or DLCD doing that prevents that from occurring?
Representative Troop, to begin with, some counties do not allow it by ordinance. But in addition,
is that a state problem? Should we legislate the counties have to do that by ordinance? Should we take that responsibility away from them at the state level?
No, I'm not recommending that, Representative. What I was trying to clarify was the impression that it's something easy to do to separate off unproductive land.
It is not easy to do because through the county ordinances or through state statute?
Well, through it depends. In some cases, it's not easy to do through county ordinances, as in our county. And also, if you look at the litigation under 215.213, starting with the Rutherford case, the standard is so strict that it's extremely difficult to, one, identify it as non-farm land, and then to meet the test that it's generally unsuitable for the production of livestock crops, because of vegetation, soil, et cetera, et cetera.
Would this marginal lands bill make it easier? Or would this have nothing to do with it?
It would probably have nothing to do with it. I don't believe that it would meet the area of farm that's not being used would meet the marginal lands test. I'm not in favor of loosening that up anyway as far as our county's concerned. But.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I guess while we've got Mr. Benner here, I'll just have to bring up the High Mesa case down in Roseburg, which is basically way beyond Type 4. Rock bluffs and steep terrain, and was challenged by the Friends on the basis that it may or may not be vineyard land, and that, of course, they hadn't made the proper findings to say that it wasn't good cropland. I think, you know, it's a rather classic case, a rather classic example of why we're not being able to take marginal land and build houses on.
Representative Anderson, I handled that case the first time it went through. I believe you said it was way beyond Class 4.
As a matter of fact, it's class 3 and class 4 soils. And the reason we represented Richard Summer, who's the founder and operator of Hillcrest Vineyard, and he was opposed to the subdivision of that land because of what it was going to do to his vineyard operation. He's the oldest modern vintner in the state. I'm sure you're very familiar with his operation. Also, now, if the marginal lands bill passes, I'd say, you know, that area is in dispute between Richard Summer and Douglas County. If the marginal lands bill passes, I'd say there's a fair chance that the area around Richard Summer's vineyard would qualify as marginal land because it's been broken into small ownerships, leaving aside the High Mesa Estates situation. And obviously he's quite nervous about this bill. He's been reassured that the minimum lot size in marginal lands will probably protect him from disaster. But the High Mesa Estates property, which is 110 acres in a single ownership, is bordered on the north by 80 acres of land that's being put into forest production, and 400 acres on the west that is used for grazing. It's not the greatest land in the world. But the reason for the lawsuit was Richard Summer trying to protect his vineyard investment.
Okay, I would like to, since that, I mean, it to some degree pertains to the bill, I would like to get back on track a little bit on the bill. Go ahead and finish, Representative Anderson, though.
First of all, we've had testimony that any land exceeding 20 degrees was way on down the line in soil type, etc., etc., and all the rock contracts and so on. I'm very familiar with it. I at one time owned a 6-acre piece and a 10-acre piece within a half a mile of that piece of property, and of course sold to Richard Summer at Hillcrest to raise 16 acres of grapes. So I'm extremely familiar with it. And I know Richard Summer's problem, and of course that was filed before we had the right to farm legislation, which we did come through with. And he is certainly worried about his farming practices of bird guns and sprays and et cetera, and I sympathize with that. But I'm still of the opinion that it's a typical marginal piece of land, so, and there's where we, I guess, part company.
Lois, would you, to get us sort of back on track, the question was asked quite a while ago by Representative Parkinson about the income test. Why have the income test? And that's, I think, what you came up to
speak
to.
Thank you, Representative Lee. I believe it was Representative Parkinson who talked about the 20-mile distance. And may I comment on that also? For one thing, as I know, commercial farmers and the cost of moving machinery, if a farmer was putting together, as most of us do, operations that include probably a home base plus a number of lease parcels and sometimes owned parcels, which are a distance. But if he owned a 20-acre parcel 10 or 20 miles away and was only making $1,000 gross on it, I'm sure he wouldn't continue to farm it. He would either rent it out to someone else. I mean, a farmer doesn't go 20 miles for $1,000 gross.
Madam Chair, Mrs. Carnegie, you make it 3 miles in. I don't think there's really any difference.
Well, our farm operation goes at the present time over 10 miles. We farm over a 10-mile distance from one strawberry field to another strawberry field. When we started farming 27—I married my husband 27 years ago, and he was farming before that, but basically at that time, our land was scattered much further than that because we were putting together a farm operation. He is neither the son of a farmer nor am I the daughter of a farmer. And so we were putting together establishing a farm operation with pieces of leased land, and we found them where we could, and they were scattered quite far, and we would go a distance if that land was fertile and could contribute to our farm operation of sweet corn and strawberries and green beans and so forth. Now, the reason that the $20,000 test is so important is because there are two ways of getting marginal land. One is the ranch, and I think other people can speak to the Eastern Southern Oregon concepts of the poor land quality, but when I think of the small ownership criteria, then I know lots of 20 and 15 and 17 acre parcels that are part of major operations, major commercial operations, that produce a lot more than 20,000 gross. And I think just because we're going with a small ownership test also, and that does affect some very fertile class 2 soils, class 1 possibly also, class 1, 2, 3 soils, then it's very important that that land not be removed from farm operation. I just asked my husband last evening after I went home from participating in the work session whether he had a map of an area where we farm in North Albany, and he pulled out a copy of an assessor's map, and you can't see very much from here, but our strawberries that are over there came from a small piece like this, you know, fit in among some subdivisions which should not have occurred, but occurred well before land use planning. And those parcels put together are a very important part, not only of the Carnegie operation, but of commercial agriculture and that surrounds the urban areas. It surrounds Albany and Corvallis, and I would guess it surrounds Salem also. When you get further away from the city, you have less problems there.
Representative Hill and then Representative Trahan.
I believe Representative Trahan was first, Madam Chair.
No, I had you on your list earlier from your last question.
Whoever gets called first is first. Okay. Lois, what...